This is Law and Disorder.
Today in Law and Disorder, the second part of our interview with our own Heidi Boghossian, who's just written the excellent book, Spying on Democracy.
It's a frightening book of how government surveillance, corporate power, tries to get everything they can about you. But it also talks about public resistance.
We'll talk about America's entitlement to do humanitarian intervention in Syria and the degree of credibility of its intelligence.
Humanitarian intervention, at least as practiced in the last number of years, is a new variation of what Kipling called the white man's burden.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We want to share with you an update on Lynn Stewart. We recently had a letter from her, a short letter, which I'd like to read to you. It starts off, as the days dwindle down to a precious few, September. The words of the beautiful old September song really resonate right now. As a matter of fact, Ralph and I sang a chorus in the visiting room here in the prison yesterday. We are now once again on the wait. Carswell Prison has my reapplication. Of course, it's even more urgent as the prognosis is shortened by time itself and the progression of the evil disease, the cancer, that is. I'm engaged in a new chemo, and it seems to give me aches and pains and a loss of stamina, but nothing terribly debilitating, thank goodness.
This is Michael Ratner, finishing Lynn Stewart's letter. That was Michael Smith. Here is how the last paragraph reads. Because of past experience, all of it, we are putting into place a plan for local demos, vigils, all over the country, on October 8th, my birthday. Save the date. It will highlight my ongoing fight against the unreasonable prison system and also that of all my fellow political prisoners. Basically, our theme, still in progress, is to fight this illegal imposition of my, quote, death penalty, end quote, especially as on that date, I am celebrating 74 wonderful years on the planet. We hope to be able to enlist many organizations, especially the local lawyers' guilds, and hope to have the flowering of many blooms. We will announce details as they become available, but don't be shy. Step right up. Organize something where you live. Call Ralph, 917-853-9759. Remember, the ending lyrics of the September song are, "These precious days I'll spend with you. Make it happen. Love, struggle, Lynn." Michael Smith will now update you on a letter the National Lawyers Guild and other organizations have written to Eric Holder.
The letter is dated September 11th, 2013, and it's a letter to Holder, the Attorney General, that requests a compassionate release. It's a re-request, a compassionate release for Lynn Stewart. We're going to link to the letter at lawanddisorder.org. And I just wanted to read to you the last paragraph of the letter that was sent to Eric Holder. If she remains in prison, Miss Stewart will die within 1 or 2 years as a direct result of the limited medical treatment available to her in the Bureau of Prisons. Given her complex medical needs and the resource demands for providing adequate medical and rehabilitative care, compassionate release will permit Miss Stewart to immediately secure medical care at the New York medical facility that treated her prior to her imprisonment at no cost to the Bureau of Prisons. In the spirit of your well-received remarks to the American Bar Association Convention, the undersigned organizations and individuals join in urging you to direct Mr. Samuels of the Bureau of Prisons to make a proper motion for compassionate release of Lynn Stewart. And it's signed by the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund in Washington, and many other organizations and individuals. Let's hope they do the right thing.
And the days grow short. The leaves to flame. One hasn't got time for the waiting game. For the days these few precious days I'll spend with you.
Michael, over time, of course, we've covered Mamiya, his getting off of death row, his continued unjust imprisonment. Heidi, of course, has been very, very involved with Mamiya. And recently, although she couldn't be here today, she sent us an update on something that happened in Philadelphia at a performance by Public Enemy. What was that, Michael?
Chuck D from Public Enemy was performing at a hip-hop concert in Philadelphia on Labor Day. Of course, Mamiya was framed up and condemned in Philadelphia. And there's a huge cop movement that's still mobilized to keep him in prison. Chuck D performed, and there's a huge banner there that proclaimed support for the release of Mamiya, and then another banner that said, "Hands off Assata," that's Assata Shakur. It drove the Republicans in Philadelphia crazy. So Heidi's been following this closely and wanted us to mention Chuck D and Public Enemy made an impact in Philadelphia.
Now, Michael, is another update, although things are moving very quickly. There are, of course, two 9/11s that we should all be conscious of. One we're overly conscious of in a way of putting in the heaviest security and warlike instruments this nation has probably ever known. And the other, of course, is the U.S. backing of the overthrow of the democratically elected government 40 years ago, September 11th, 1973, in Chile. It does bring to mind, though, what's going on with Syria. And I was having a discussion with Michael Smith the other day, and we've now seen, of course, Obama have to pull back, and back. And it's really the first time since 9/11 that the U.S. opposition has increased to the extent and the world opposition to the U.S. going to war again and again. And Michael had a comment about that or a thought about it.
Well, it was a tremendous victory for the anti-war movement, even though there's no real leadership and there's no movement in the streets like there was during Vietnam. Nonetheless, there's such broad and deep anti-war sentiment in this country that this was reflected in Congress, and it looked to the Obama administration like they weren't going to get their warmongering bill passed through Congress. I think we can credit that to people's feeling like they got misled and burned by Iraq, that there were no weapons of mass destruction. It came out that there wasn't, that the whole war against Iraq, which cost the lives of thousands of Americans and about a million Iraqis, it was a pretext. It was an illegal war. It was a war crime. And I think that the U.S. government, even though it has designs on Syria, because they don't want any kind of independent country like Syria or Iran in that area, but their designs on Syria have at least been delayed, if not diffused.
You know, I think it's actually a huge blow to the empire, the U.S. empire. You know, they wanted to do this bombing. Obama was going to do it on his own, still insists he has the right to do it on his own. But obviously, once the British Parliament said no, he really had no other allies, nothing left except now the new French poodle, literally, that was going to go along with him. And of course, the U.S., as you said, Michael Smith, the opposition was huge. So then he says, OK, I'll go to Congress, let them maybe bite the bullet. And then, of course, he was going to lose almost for sure in the House. And it looked like he was even going down in the Senate. At that point, like a drowning government or a drowning man or a drowning imperialism, where does the lifeline come from?
It comes from the Russians. It
comes from the Russians, no less. And at first they looked like they maybe pretend nervous about grasping that life preserver in the water. But in the end, they not only grasped it, they embraced it and are running with it. I mean, as we speak, perhaps the foreign minister of Russia, Lavrov, is meeting with our head of the Department of State, Kerry, to try and iron out what's going to happen. Look, there's cautions here. We don't know what's going to happen. The U.S. still wants to link the control of chemical weapons in Syria with a resolution that will use force if it doesn't go the way it wants to. There's dangers here. But in fact, I think right now I would read this as a great blow against country Martin Luther King, called the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Now, Michael, you know, as I sit here with you recording these amazing updates, there's so many all the time, just on my BlackBerry, and I'll just say this, as we say in law, res ipsa loquitur. What does that mean, Michael?
The thing speaks for itself.
So here is the email I got, the latest from Greenwald and Poitras. Greenwald, of course, is Glenn Greenwald. Poitras is Laura Poitras, the video film person and writer who's living in Berlin. And it's from The Guardian. And I'll just read a few of the quotes that they pull out. NSA, shares raw intelligence, including Americans' data, with Israel. And here's the points. Secret deal places no legal limits on use of data by Israelis. Only official U.S. government communications protected. Agency insists it complies with rules governing privacy. Then, this is a nice one, read the NSA and Israel's Memorandum of Understanding. And it's by Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and another Guardian writer, Ewan McCaskill, and goes on and about what that agreement is and how it works. So I leave it to our listeners to look up that article in The Guardian. Again, it's on the U.S. and the NSA sharing its intelligence on all of us, perhaps, with Israel.
And why not? Israel is the U.S. aircraft carrier in the Middle East.
Speaking of war on Syria, and of course the U.S. claim about chemical weapons, et cetera, of which they have not been able to give the evidence that would be sufficient, and even then it wouldn't give them a right to attack Syria. A recent report came out again today, I just read this. The UN rights panel cites evidence of war crimes by both sides in Syria. And I'll just read you the paragraph so we understand that the view we're getting by most of the media in the United States is that it's Syria that's committing human rights violations and the other side is not. Quote, relentless shelling has killed thousands of civilians and displaced the populations of entire towns, the UN report said. Massacres and other unlawful killings are perpetrated with impunity. An untold number of men, children, and women have disappeared. Many have died in detention. And then the report goes on to say, the perpetrators of these violations and crimes on all sides act in defiance of international law. They do not fear accountability. Referral to justice is imperative. So two things about that report. One is referral to justice is imperative. That doesn't mean bombing and killing more civilians. And secondly, both sides are responsible for human rights violations here. But somehow, all we hear about is the U.S. should intervene on one side and bomb and kill more civilians than have already been killed. Michael, a week or so ago, a federal district court in Texas imposed what we lawyers referred to as a gag order on both lawyers and the defendant himself, Barrett Brown, who is facing multiple counts of various alleged crimes having to do with computers and other kinds of things. The underlying crime that people have been outraged by or alleged crime is the one where he pasted a link that was already in the public, pasted it into a chat room, I think is what it was. And it was the link to Stratford documents. And among those 5 million Stratford documents or something like that, there were some credit card numbers. And of course, I don't know whether you even knew that, but that link was public. And so people are pretty outraged that a journalist like Barrett Brown would be indicted for posting a public link into another forum, into a chat room. And so the underlying charge is terrible. There are two very fine lawyers defending Barrett Brown in Texas. And recently the government came in and said, we want a gag order about what they can say about the trial and what Barrett Brown can say about his own trial. So what was the order that was given, Michael, and how do you think about that?
Barrett Brown, of course, was central as one of the key journalists that covered Anonymous. So he was targeted by the government, made the mistake with a keystroke of forwarding that link to those documents. So he was indicted, and the government went looking for his computer. He took it over to his mother's house. So he was indicted and charged with crimes that would amount to 106 years in prison. Goes over to his mother's house with the computer. Government comes over looking for the computer. They charge his mother with hiding evidence. So his mother is now looking at a year in prison. Brown was so upset about what's happening to his mother that he said some nasty, threatening things about the FBI agents that came over to his mother's house. So they loaded those charges on him. Now he's attempting to explain his situation, and the government puts a gag order on him and his lawyers. We'll keep following this case because there's no gag order on us.
Let me say a word about the gag order. You know, there's rules of ethics that lawyers have to follow. And the judge, in the opinion, says, and we admonish the lawyers to follow the rule of ethics. You know, these lawyers had never violated the rule of ethics. And then the judge is coming down and saying they shouldn't violate it. I mean, it's an outrage with two very, very respected lawyers, both of whom I know. And what's unfair about it is, you know, the government piles on the prejudice about his case, you know, with press when he's arrested, with an indictment, et cetera. And all that's happening, if they had been allowed to speak, is a way of trying to even out the balance between the government's propaganda about Barrett Brown and what really should be a fair way of describing the case. And the idea that, as the judge said, that the judge is going to prevent Barrett Brown from prejudicing his own case is completely crazy. I mean, it's crazy. So it's left to me, Michael Smith, myself, and hopefully hundreds of other people and journalists out there to cover Barrett Brown's trial fairly and in a way in which we don't just see people say, oh, Barrett Brown is a bad guy, he's guilty, let's get him. In fact, the press has been doing better on him a bit. They've been talking about how outrageous it is that he's being prosecuted for this link. There was a recent piece in the New York Times by David Carr about it that actually, I think, gave substance to the claim that he's being unfairly prosecuted.
Well, they did to him what they did to Aaron Swartz, what they did to Lynn Stewart. They totally overcharged him. They very cynically charged Lynn with crimes that would amount to 30 years in prison, and then got convictions on all accounts. They did the same with Aaron Swartz, driving him to suicide. And now they've done that to Barrett Brown. So stay tuned on this program. We're going to cover this case.
We go now to Heidi Boghossian, where she will discuss in part two her new, important, remarkable book, Spying on Democracy: Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. First of all, it's a very easy-to-read book, and it's very accessible with lots of good stories about how the surveillance is working from the time kids were sent home with computers from their school that actually could, the cameras could be turned on so the school could watch the kids, to the mannequin story you just heard, to other stories which we'll get to about bikes in New York City, about the labor organizing my son does down for Coalition of Immokalee Workers and what happened there. But let's just give a sense of the overview. It's a dozen, how many chapters altogether, Heidi? It's 13 chapters plus the conclusion, and it includes everything from what happened with the arrests of critical mass in New York City and the spying on that bike group, going down through putting spies into political groups, and to origins of where a lot of the spying took place, to what's happening with what Heidi calls green squads, you know, everything from the green movement to animal rights movement, to spying on the press, which is, I think, maybe what we'll talk about next, private contracting, the eyes above. You know, they used to call the people who parachuted down and killed you death from above in the Army. Now they look at everything you do. It's celestial eyes, Heidi calls it. And then, of course, which we'll get to, the fight back. But Heidi, I saw you pointing to spying on the press. So let's talk about your chapter on spying on the press.
Well, because the title is Spying on Democracy, I think spying on the press really gets to the heart of what we're talking about. All of this surveillance, be it corporate government and the joining of the two, has a chilling effect on free speech, because when you know you're being monitored, even in outdoor situations, it tends to change the way you communicate with others. And I think that we've seen under the Obama administration the crackdown on journalists' threat of charges of espionage or conspiracy with confidential sources. When you are spying on the Fourth Estate, as it's called, which is intended to be a watchdog on government, you really get to the heart of what democracy is about. And without a free press, we don't have any chance of preserving those fundamental freedoms of First Amendment association and ability to bring our grievances to the government for redress. In that chapter, I talk about the Hewlett-Packard scandal.
Oh, that was a great one.
Yeah,
right.
The use of so-called pretexting. Right.
Like, I know, because I do this work with Assange and everybody, I know about some of the other ones, but the Hewlett-Packard one I'd forgotten about. Why don't you tell our listeners?
Hewlett-Packard basically experienced some negative leaks coming out about some corporate policies several years ago. And what they did was they hired one or two of these small private intelligence firms, a la Stratfor, but on a smaller level. I think they were from Florida. And their staff members pretended they were members of the press. And they got their, I guess, social security numbers and called the telephone company, impersonating them, engaged in what's called pretexting, which is now in many states held to be illegal, to get detailed information about their family, their lives, whatever, to try to get at who had leaked the information from Hewlett-Packard. And there were hearings on this. Several Hewlett-Packard vice presidents resigned over it. It was a scandal. But it shows that corporations will engage in so-called dirty tricks, a la Richard Nixon, to get at this information. And again, it's big business. It's lucrative to the private security industry. And it's spying, as we know, among corporations to protect trade secrets and keep things secret is a big business in and of itself.
Well, let's talk about how spies set down on the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. You've got some of the poorest, most vulnerable people in the country. At the end of the year, they'll make maybe $6,500. They're picking tomatoes in Florida.
That's chapter two. It's called A Whopper, presumably referring to a hamburger of some sort.
Affirmative.
A Coke, which is, not referring to a drink. And an Order of Spies. So
good title.
It's about corporate spying.
Corporate spying on activists. And in this case, it involved the fast food industry in Florida, where, as you know, tomatoes are a huge industry. And as Jake Ratner and many others have been fighting through the Coalition of Immokalee Workers to raise, even just by pennies, the hourly wages of individuals who pick tomatoes and really are mistreated in many ways. And what happened was a student group working with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers got suspicious because a new member on one of their listservs started asking questions. And they did some research and found out that she owned her own private security company. In fact, she was spying on them for Burger King. And even a vice president of Burger King went on a listserv and wrote disparaging remarks about this student group. But it shows the extent to which corporations, I think, very much fear successful activists who bring into the public forum messages about injustices. And they target them as though they are criminals and engage in some really surreptitious and nasty tactics.
You know, I think in one way that's a very optimistic message, because we all think these are huge corporations with all this money. But you see how much affected they are, even by small movements that oppose some of their depredations and illegalities. And to me, it's a sign of just to keep fighting when you get that, and that they'll go to great lengths. So I understand that from Heidi's book, but that how they do take seriously when you organize against them. And so that's a wonderful chapter. The other thing I wanted to mention, there's something here that I had never seen the word before. It's a chapter called Computers Can't Commit Crime. And there's a word in there, axion or something, spelled
X-I-O-M. Axiom is one of the largest data aggregators in the country. They're based in Texas. If you saw the New York Times last week, there was a huge story because Congress is calling for an investigation into these large data aggregators. Once again, there's no oversight. There's no accountability. They go to a variety of sources to gather personal information on us, some in the public domain, others not. And they have really vast troves, electronic dossiers on each of us. Axiom has sort of started to come out on the defensive by creating a site that they're about to unfold, I believe, that allows people to go and see some of the information that they've collected on you. And Natasha Singer, a reporter for The Times, has covered them over the years. Why they're doing that is in anticipation of a government crackdown calling for more accountability. So this makes them seem very good in certain ways, that they're trying to be transparent. It allows people to correct some of the information that's been gathered on them for inaccuracies. And in all of the book, I talk about how so much of the data being amassed contains numerous inaccuracies, and there's no way for us to correct that information. Plus, one of the problems is that some information, if gotten into the hands of people who are not supposed to see it, well, they can alter that information, say, about our financial histories, our medical records. So it's ripe for tampering. But Axiom is coming out with a way for us to see some of what they collect on us. And critics are saying that in many ways it's a very clever device because it will allow us to correct and give even more information about ourselves to allow advertisers to target us more specifically.
One of the points you make, and I think it can't be repeated enough, is the one that law enforcement agencies are somewhat inhibited because they're part of the government, you know. But these corporation spies, these private spies, brag that they can do more.
In effect, they're serving as the long arm of the government.
Yeah,
and that's why I think the government relishes cooperation with top CEOs from telecommunications and other corporations. There's an advisory panel comprised of CEOs of these big businesses that help shape government policy and advise the commander-in-chief.
Heidi, what was it that came about that caused you to write this book? Where did the book come from your experiences?
As you know, through my work at the National Lawyers Guild and my interest in law enforcement, I've watched over the last 15 or 20 years really an increased militarization of police treatment of protesters in the streets. And I'm aware, since the Guild was spied on, and we joke that they're listening in on all of our conversations, which is really not a joking matter, but a lot of people find that hard to take seriously. I'm hoping that will change, because I think we're all being monitored. But I started to see through retailers, especially with the growth of loyalty cards. I was on a plane and they tried to get me to sign up for a credit card. And I just realized that every interaction on your computer, you buy something and then all of a sudden ads for the same product pop up. So understanding what's happened with lawyering and lawyers being afraid in some cases to represent unpopular clients because fear of government reprisal, I just started looking at the many different ways that different people are being spied on and realized that it's everywhere. And now with Ed Snowden and The Guardian's reports, and it seems every day something new comes out that lets us see that it's not the exception, it's really the norm.
We're speaking with Heidi Boghossian, author and, of course, co-host with Michael Smith and myself of Law and Disorder. Her new book is called Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. I want to say a couple of things about the book and the cover. One, the cover has a picture of a fingerprint on it, Heidi, and I know our listeners are going to want to know, is that your fingerprint? Are you giving that fingerprint to the government, Heidi?
I think the government already has my fingerprint,
oh,
Michael.
She's not answering the question.
There's also an eyeball on that fingerprint.
Well, yeah, there is.
Does the government have a retinal scan on you too?
But the fingerprint, and she just so you know, for all of you fingerprint aficionados, it has a swirly center with a little few ridges here and there. And it's, I would say it's probably Heidi's fingerprint, but I don't know, actually. But that's one reason to get the book, if you want a copy of Heidi's fingerprint, Spying on Democracy. The other interesting thing to me, of course, it's published by City Lights Book, which for most of you are probably too young to know, but that was the bookstore, and still is, in San Francisco publisher that first published the first edition of Allen Ginsberg's poem, Howl, that great poem. So there you go. But Heidi, my last question to you, we may have more, has to do with the chapter of hope. You know, this book gives an incredible overview, and Lewis Lapham, who former editor of Harper's, wrote this beautiful paragraph describing the book. Heidi Boghossian shows the hydra-headed data banks to be targeting all sectors of American society. School children, the mothers of school children, church congregations, credit card members, and Facebook friends. Everybody and anybody at work or play with tracking devices, otherwise known as cell phones. That's Lewis's. My sort of last question for Heidi, although we can go on and on about this, has to do with the Hope chapter. And that comes toward the end, although each chapter talks about heroic people, from the bike chapter in New York and Critical Mass. Each one talks about those willing to take on the surveillance and undemocratic state. But this one's called Troublemakers Bring Us to Our Senses.
No. That was the Occupy chapter.
Well, that's hopeful.
It was, but Custodians of Democracy is the Hope.
It's true.
Chapter.
Good groups here.
Good
groups, but there's two. I would say 13 and 14 give it to us, because the Occupy chapter it talks a lot about, and then Custodians of Democracy. So tell us how you see the hope for the future here, Heidi.
I was particularly struck by a few examples of children, as I mentioned earlier, were asked to scan their palms in order to get into the school cafeteria for lunch. I thought that was astonishing.
It's really.
And one
is astonishing. The kind of lunch they were anticipating getting.
One girl and her family took it to court And you know how difficult that is, especially for a young kid who then faces peer pressure. But there was also a story of people in a California town whose mayor had approved, I think, the use of a drone. And they said, no, we don't want this. It's unacceptable. And they fought it. And he, you know, he rescinded that. So no drones in one municipality in California. It's sometimes so easy for us to lose sight of how embedded technology is in everything that we do. And we're reliant on it, and it makes life, as the inventors of the internet had hoped, more open to, I think, creativity, imagination, and linkages. On the other hand, as with all technology, it can be used by the government and corporations and others for insidious purposes. And I think we've seen too much a shift in that direction, and we need to really try to bring back communities of people talking to one another and not relying so much on technology when it's used for those restrictive purposes. And the shroud of secrecy that we see the Obama administration really engaging in terms of classifying more documents, cracking down on the press, criminalizing certain internet behaviors, is not what the creators of the internet and others envisioned. And I think we really have to share human stories to replace the corporate narrative and the status quo that so much this corporate government state wants us to abide by and stifle us and really cripple our First Amendment and Fourth Amendment protections. So I list several individuals and groups. A group in Boston that fights for children's rights and against advertisers, and many others regarding free press and people who are inventing new technologies to try to protect us. So I thought those were all stories of hope and inspiration, and we need to focus more on the human-to-human interactions rather than rely on the government and corporations.
Yeah, as Martin Luther King said, there is such a thing as too late. And this book is an inspiration to start fighting back. It's called Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance by Heidi Boghossian.
Heidi, again, thank you for this powerful book. It really gives the best overview I know of what's happened, not just since 9/11, but the roots of the spying apparatus in the United States, because they don't want democracy, real democracy here. So thank you, Heidi Boghossian, for writing this really fine book.
Thank you, Heidi.
Thank you.
We also wanted to mention for our New York listeners that our own Heidi Boghossian is speaking tomorrow about her new book, Spying on Democracy in New York, at Revolution Books. That's Tuesday, September 17th at 7 p.m. Revolution Books is located at 146 West 26th Street, between 6th and 7th Avenues. We hope to see you there.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
What is the difference between an illegal war and humanitarian intervention. We talk today about Syria and humanitarian intervention with Ajamu Baraka, the founding executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network from 2004 to 2011. Currently, he's a member of the Coordinating Committee of Black Left Unity and also an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Ajamu Baraka, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Ajamu, even if, let's suppose, President Obama was correct in the intelligence that he cited to demonstrate that Assad intentionally used poison gas on his people, what is the doctrine of humanitarian intervention that would allow, as he asserted, the United States to go ahead on its own to bomb Syria?
Well, there's no basis in international law that allows the U.S. or any sovereign state to take that kind of unilateral action. If there is an egregious violation of international standards and law related to aggression against one's own citizens or a breach of the peace, those questions are supposed to be taken up by the United Nations Security Council. But this notion of humanitarian intervention and the responsibility to protect is a particular kind of creation that's cooked up in the West that has provided some kind of a moral justification for unilateral actions or a collection of states to engage in actions on behalf of the quote-unquote world community to circumvent the United Nations, to impose their own particular understanding and vision of international order on any nation that they see fit. It is a toxic and nauseous sort of a creation that, in my opinion, is no more than a sort of dressed-up rearticulation of the white man's burden, this notion that the U.S. And European ex-colonial nations have a right and a responsibility to impose their particular interests, worldviews on the rest of humanity is a notion that needs to be rejected, but it's something that many people in the West have embraced.
Well, that white man's burden notion came from Rudyard Kipling, who was kind of a cheerleader for British imperialism 100 years ago. What kind of examples would you give of the United States using that notion currently, not just in Syria?
It was the foundation for the NATO intervention into Libya. It has been the justification for explaining the intervention into Kosovo. That's when those notions were really first articulated and then more formalized in the 2000s. It's been the underlying sort of justifications for many of the moves that have been made in U.S. Middle East policy for the last decade or so. It's been very skillfully implanted in the minds of many people in this country as a justification for unilateral actions on the part of the U.S. or in conjunction, again, with European allies.
President Obama was saying that we've got to save the lives of these children expiring on cold, hard hospital floors. And are you saying, Ajamu, that there's another interest, sort of a hidden agenda of the United States in Syria and in the Middle East generally?
If the concern was humanitarian concerns and the images that they circulated yesterday with the very gruesome pictures of people who were in the last stages of life, I pose the question, what about the images that we were bombarded with, the rows of piled up bodies from Egypt? Well, we watched on primetime television the systematic slaughter of some people say up to 2,000 or more human beings who were engaged in peaceful demonstrations by a U.S.-backed Egyptian military. Why are those lives less important than those lives of people who died in Syria? Is it the mode of how they were murdered, gas versus conventional U.S. supplied weapons? So for me and for many people who are thinking and watching these situations unfold, it has to be other interests, other ulterior motives that has driven the U.S. to take the U.S. To war on behalf of these victims in Syria.
You know, you pointed out, really, and the way I heard what you were saying is that as you point to Egypt and the massacres that took place there recently, with no intervention by the U.S., in fact, support for the Egyptian army, it looks more and more to me, and I think it should to others, and I think that's what you're saying, is that the human rights claims that the U.S. is making about Assad in Syria are a pretext for going into Syria for whatever other purposes they are. I want to get to that and what you think the other purposes are. But the other, of course, recent example is when the Israelis slaughtered 1,400 Palestinians in Gaza 4 years ago, and the U.S. didn't lift a finger while that massacre was going on. So let me go back to that question. What do you think, then, if human rights are not the reason, even though that's what's being sold to the American people, what's really going on that the U.S. wants to intervene in Syria at this point?
I think the U.S. Objective is dismemberment of the Syrian state. They are almost in a win-win situation. Either they effect regime change and allow this motley crew of oppositional forces that are many of it is aligned with international jihadist movements to come to power, or they force the state to become a non-functional state. Either way, their longer-term objective, which is to further isolate Iran, to diminish the power of Russia, those objectives are met to increase the power and remove the potential threat to Israel. All of those strategic objectives are, in fact, met. So those are, I believe, and many people believe, are the driving motivations for this so-called civil war that's been fomented in Syria, and the drive toward a military strike right at the moment when it was clear that the Assad government had turned the tide militarily on the ground. The U.S. decided they was going to intervene to affect the equalization of forces, if you will, in Syria.
Yeah, I'm sure you follow, as I do, although the American press doesn't seem to very much, is the actual intervention that's already taken place by the U.S., which is the training of Syrians in Jordan to go across and fight on behalf and against Assad, actually, on behalf of the rebels. And I think hundreds of them have actually been infiltrated across as a way of, you, as you pointed out, the reasons for it. But I'm interested in both your comments on that is the recent events that have happened. Obama's speech last week, the pulling back of a plan that he had to bomb Syria, you know, almost for sure, even without Congress, is going to Congress. And now President Putin giving him a lifeline.
It's been an amazing week. It's clear that the U.S. found itself deeply isolated, especially once the British Parliament decided that they were not going to allow David Cameron to take the government into another ill-advised adventure in the Middle East. It seemed, and with the clear indications that there was not going to be a veil of legitimacy provided by the U.N., and most of public opinion around the world opposed to any kind of direct military intervention by the U.S., the U.S. found itself in a very unique, isolated position that appears to have pushed the Obama administration to at least have the authority of Congress behind him in this strike that they were contemplating. It was a situation that was really untenable, with the lifeline provided to the administration by Russia as a consequence of what many of us believe to be a mistake made by Kerry the other day. He has been given an opportunity to pull back from this ill-advised strike, something that I think is in the benefit of the U.S. because the interventions and the chaos that have occurred so far in Syria has only resulted in mass chaos throughout the entire region. So it is an interesting set of events over the last few days. It provides the possibility of some kind of negotiated settlement for the situation in Syria.
Yeah, I think it's just extraordinary Michael and I believe that it's a big victory for the American people not to be drawn into this. It's a victory for the anti-war movement, even though there's no anti-war movement. I think it's kind of a payback for the deception that the Bush regime practiced on the American people when it lied about weapons of mass destruction. And now the public opinion is quite skeptical about what the government tries to sell. But I wanted to switch gears, if I might, and ask you this. You know, you and I are old friends. I know you from the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I had a discussion with you years ago about Obama. You were one of the few people on the left that did not support Obama. I remember Gore Vidal observing that the four sweetest words in the English language is, "I told you so." How do you feel now about Obama after 5 years in office, and who really does he represent?
Well, I wish I could have been proven wrong, and I really welcome the fact that many on the so-called left, and particularly in my community, in the African American community, have finally sort of woken up from this fog of the Obama phenomenon. It's been a disaster. I think the Obama administration has been one of the most effective weapons ever deployed against the progressive and radical movement here in this country, perhaps in the whole post-war period. He has been the answer to Ronald Reagan, but even a more effective communicator than even Ronald Reagan, and a more effective demobilizer, if you will, than Ronald Reagan. For progressive forces here in this country, his administration has been an absolute and complete disaster. It has demobilized the anti-war movement. It has confused traditional liberals. It has disarmed radicals and a radical critique. It has been effective in advancing one of the most aggressive periods of American foreign policy that we've seen in many years. So it's been a complete and absolute disaster for progressive forces here in this country. But I think that we're seeing the corner turn. You referenced the anti-war movement. Well, being in shatters, and it was. But this last overreach by the administration had the result of helping to re-galvanize that movement. There were demonstrations across the country, not at the level we saw in the run-up to the Iraqi war, but there have been impressive actions throughout the country. And beyond the anti-war movement, we see that among a number of progressive elements, they have finally begun to have the courage to reveal, or to at least provide a critique that exposes the race and class interests represented by Obama, the person, and his administration. And all of that we see as very positive developments that shows us that we still have the foundation for expanding progressive movement here in this country.
Where would you like to see things go from here in terms of your perspective and your most optimistic hopes about how we might strategize and where do we go and how do we get there?
I think we use this last incident to intensify the conversations around exposing the interests of this administration. We know that in the next couple of weeks we're going to have a very intense debate around the budget, with the possibility of the government being shut down again. That's going to allow us to refocus, I think, attention on the economic contradictions here in the U.S. and globally, and to raise up the elements that need to be focused on regarding how the economy is organized, who benefits from the economy, what kinds of policies have not been put in place to address some of the pain and sufferings of the working class in this country, what kinds of policies are being imposed on people around the world to strengthen and expand the hegemony of global capital. So we have an opportunity to really begin to intensify the ideological struggle, if you will, to take advantage of the crisis that the ruling elements have been facing for the last few years here in the country, in this country, and in the West in general. So I'm optimistic that if we are able to shake ourselves from the the effects of the growing strength of liberals through these liberal NGOs, of the confusion that radicals have been exposed to and articulating for the last few years. If we can shake all that off, I think we have the possibility of recouping some of the lost terrain that and momentum that we have over the last few years and going forward in a very positive way.
Let me ask you, if our listeners want to keep up with your writings and your activities, how do they do that?
Well, I've been forced, because this is a new reality, to develop and establish a website, a blog site, if you will. So I was reluctant because it seems so individualistic, but that's what we do nowadays. So it's Ajamu Baraka, AjamuBaraka.com. And all of my offerings are there.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Ajamu, that was just a remarkable interview, and you're saying things that I wish everybody in this country could hear.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I really appreciate the work that you all do. Bye now.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Law and Disorder is carried on many stations throughout the country, and we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge our sister stations.
Well, first of all, we have WBAI, New York City, 99.5 FM. WHYS, Eau Claire Community Radio in Wisconsin, 96.3 FM. KRFP, Free Radio Moscow at 92.5 FM, Moscow, Idaho.
WRFN, Nashville, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, 98.9 FM. KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon, 106.7 FM. WYAP, Clay, West Virginia, 101.7 FM.
KRFC, 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT, 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD, 90.7, Kasselhof, Alaska. 104.5 FM Radio, Anchorage, Alaska.
WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts. KEIF-FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. 1640 AM, Front Royal, Virginia.
WPVM, 103.5 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana. Online to Chicago, Oakland, Atlanta, Boston, Melbourne. Moton Community House Radio, online.
WPRR, 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS, 102.1 and 98.3 FM, Columbus Community Radio, Ohio.
KKFI, 90.1 FM in Kansas City, Missouri. Free Radio Santa Cruz. WSLRM FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida.
KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Round Radio. AM 1680, Southwest 13.560, Shortwave. Lorain Community College Radio, Cleveland, Ohio. WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut.
WJFF, Radio Catskill, New York, 90.5 FM. WDRT, 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin. WERU, 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine. 99. FM, Bangor, Maine.
You were fishing in Viroqua. KMUD, Garberville, 91.1. KMUE, Eureka, 88.3. KLAI, Laytonville, 90.3. Shelter Cove, 99.5. Voice of Sacramento. Sacramento Community Radio, 88.7. MHC. WWPM, Media Network, Nokomis, Illinois.
Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR, 92.1, Provincetown, Mass. WMHC, 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass. KSER-FM, 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS, 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, 98. FM, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, 98.3 and 102.1, Columbus, Ohio.
KSKQ, 94.9, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU, 90.7 FM, Illinois Central College, Peoria, Illinois. WGCX, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York.
KSVR 91.7, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3, 89.9, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington. WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Mass.
WFTE-FM, 90.3 and 105.7, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. WRFI, 91.9, Watkins Glen, New York. WINO, 89.9, Odessa, New York. 88.1, Ithaca, New York. WEFT, 90.1, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio. Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes.
KAOS, Olympia, Washington, 89.3 FM. KWTF, Sonoma County, California. Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas.
KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, 106.1 FM. WZRD, Chicago, Illinois, 88.3 FM.
Thank you all.